This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
I'm Helen Farmer. Great to have you with us on today's episode. A really disturbing report out of the UK showing that during football tournaments, when England loses, domestic violence spikes by 38%. It even spikes when they win. We were talking about anger, about misplaced anger, and of course strategies plus resources for domestic abuse in the region too, with Dr. Bissi of Sage Clinics. Also talking education, a government directive of upskilling teachers in AI is on the cards. What can that look like in practice? And what are the potential concerns about more AI in the classroom? Dr. Neil Hopkins joined us live. Plus, it was the Ministry of Education sharing the reclassification of UAE universities. How is this going to be useful for parents and indeed students? Leadership with a difference. Coaching with horses. Janine Sudbury explaining her very innovative approach to bringing your authentic self to work. And if you're working remotely over the summer, you need to hear our recruitment industry insider's take on putting some boundaries in place. I do feel like we need to give something of a trigger warning because today we are delving into a critical and urgent issue, the link between sports events and a spike in domestic violence cases. Recent reports, including those from Shout Out UK, highlight during the Euros, instances of domestic violence increase significantly. Research shows that domestic violence cases can surge up to 38% when a favoured team loses. The troubling statistic underscores the need to understand why some, and I know men can be victims of domestic abuse, but we're talking about men in particular being perpetrators in this case, expressing disappointment through violence. And what we can I do to identify and mitigate these behaviours? Shedding light on this issue, we have got the fantastic Dr. Bissi, clinical psychologist from Sage Clinics, who's going to help us explore some of the psychological and societal factors that, you know, are at play. And of course, the text lines are open. Dr. Bissi, thank you so much for being with us. Are you shocked at that stat? And what I should also add to it, 38% increase in domestic violence cases when a favoured team loses, but even when a team wins or draws, we're still seeing a spike.
Sadly, Helen, I'm not shocked. One of the reasons that I'm not shocked is that we know that there's a high prevalence of domestic violence in general. Some stats say one in four, some say one in three women will experience some form of domestic violence at some point in their life. So those statistics are quite alarming and quite scary.
Maybe we should start by talking about what we're talking about when we're using those words domestic violence. So people are going to have different definitions, but I wondered if you could perhaps clarify how you define it and maybe encapsulate what we're going to be addressing this hour.
Yes. So when we think of domestic violence, I think the most obvious one people think of is physical violence and that kind of physical abuse. And that is one aspect or one form of abuse under the umbrella of domestic violence. But it's any form of violence that is committed within a household or within close relationships that's intended to cause harm. So this could be emotional abuse, it could be financial abuse, it could be coercion, it could be psychological. And those ones tend to be a bit more subtle and hard to share with people, but also even for the victim, hard for them to identify, especially if this is something that has been longstanding in the relationship. For example, psychological abuse, they might just see it as this is just an aspect of, oh, this is how my husband and I, this is how my partner and I, this is how my mother and I function in the relationship.
That's how we relate to each other.
Absolutely.
And as you say, it may be not a one-off incident, but it's been prolonged and repetitive.
Absolutely.
And if there's been gaslighting involved as well, you know, can kind of further muddy the waters. Let's go back to this idea of the sports events. What psychological factors do you think, Dr. Bissi, contribute to this link between sports events, and obviously Euros are on right now, and an increase in domestic violent cases? What comes to mind when you think about, well, I don't find that shocking because...
Yeah, I think one of the first things that come to mind is the emotional aspect of sports. And the reality is that sporting, especially football, it's such... It's probably one of the most popular sports, and a lot of people that are avid supporters, part of their identity is linked to like their sports team or their regional team or their national teams playing. So there's a big emotional investment, and whether your team loses or wins, there's a big emotional reaction. And if you're someone that struggles with managing your emotions generally, whether they win or lose, there will be a big emotional expression.
So it can be a conduit for emotions.
Absolutely.
I did sociology when I was younger, and I remember really vividly talking about how people who aren't religious, often religion can, well, football can fill a religion-shaped hole.
Yeah.
You know, you have this idea of, you know, this collective experience, often alcohol involved.
Absolutely.
Anticipation, crowds.
Yes.
How do kind of this kind of crowd mentality often exacerbate and even heighten emotions as well?
So two things that I want to highlight. One is what happens when you're in the crowd. So like you mentioned, alcohol and substances. And we know that during these periods of like the Euros or big competitions, there's an increase in substances. And when there's an increase in substance, there's decreased inhibition, increased expressions of like anger and aggression, impaired judgment.
Yeah, all those risky behaviours.
Exactly. All those risky behaviours that can lead to physical violence or that can lead to some form of abuse. But then also the pressures and the kind of influence that the people within the crowd, like cheering each other on and egging each other on, and some of the fights. And what we notice is sometimes there can be a thing called displacement. So that's a psychological term, like a protective mechanism or a defense mechanism, where you and I maybe are, we support opposite teams, and your team loses, or my team loses, sorry, and then you do something to antagonize me, but I can't face you. So I displace that anger, or I displace that aggression and put it on someone who's less threatening, like a partner, mm-hmm. who's probably at home or maybe watching the match, but they won't be able to stand up to me or face me the way maybe you would be. So that's some of the things that can happen when in that kind of crowd setting.
Dr. Bissy Lennon with us today, clinical psychologist from Sage Clinics. We are going to talk throughout this hour about anger management, anger issues, the role that how we grow up, you know, how are we raised to express ourselves? Really, really important topic. And of course, what, you know, domestic violence in the region, what resources are at play, because we have got a clip from a previous interview with Fatima Al-Haddad from Shamsahar, speaking to us from Bahrain. Up next, we're going to be talking about some of the early warning signs, upbringing and childhood experiences that can influence someone's way of dealing with anger and disappointment.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Recent study conducted by England's National Centre of Domestic Violence has shown some really shocking results. Whether England's national football side loses a game, domestic violence increases by up to 38%. In case of a draw or a win, there's a 26% spike in domestic violence cases. And I don't know if you saw this recently, but there was a viral hypothetical question that was asking whether women would rather encounter a bear or an unknown man in a forest, sparking really heated debate and a deeper conversation about male violence too. Thousands of women on social media revealed that they would be rather stuck with a bear than a strange man if alone in the woods, since that question took off on TikTok. We are talking anger through until 3 o'clock today. And guiding us through the topic, Dr. Bissy Lennon of Sage Clinic. She's a clinical psychologist. Can we talk about the role of upbringing and I guess parental modelling of frustration, anger, disappointment? Because that's surely our first benchmark of normality as we know it as children. Can you explain a little bit more about that and how men in particular might end up expressing themselves in a way that you know, is really damaging to themselves, to their partners, their families and society?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that even if we think about the language that we use, and even though it's 2024, a lot of this language is still widely used in families, how boys are supposed to express their anger, how boys are supposed to express things like sadness. But if we think back to parents and we think back to parenting, so for example, if a child has grown up in a family where there's that kind of insecure attachment, yeah, so there's a bit of inconsistency with parenting, mm-hmm. that child is less likely to develop effective coping skills for managing emotions, because that's not what they received. And like you said, modeling, how does dad respond to anger? Or how does dad respond to being upset about something? Mm-hmm. Is he frustrated? And when he's frustrated, is he throwing things? Does he raise his voice? These are the things that children pick up. You don't need to tell them oh, look at me and copy me. They're just copying because, like you said, that's your first frame of reference. That's your first point of how to navigate these emotions and also how to navigate the world.
I really let myself down at the weekend, parentally.
What did you do?
It doesn't happen very often that I lose my temper. I'm genuinely a very kind of content, calm person. I get frustrated, of course I do with my kids, but I'm going to keep it very, very vague. My daughter and a couple of friends did something that I was very disappointed in and I lost it. I like smashed a broom, that kind of lost it. Mm. And I said to her, I was like, have you seen me get that angry before? And she's like, no, never. And I had to then do the repair of going, I'm so sorry. Yeah. I don't like losing my temper. I don't like, you know, raising my voice. I don't want to embarrass you in front of my friends. But it was like the red mist had descended. But I was so conscious of like, I need to repair and apologize as soon as possible. And it was within minutes. And then, but it really shook me up because I did completely lose control.
But that's also a good example of good modelling, because the reality is that there will be times where we might lose our temper and we might lose our anger, and our children might see it and they might witness it. Mm-hmm. This isn't about shielding them from extreme emotions, because the reality is that they also will experience extreme emotions. But what you did was that repair work. Yeah, and that talking to your child and saying that actually I lost it and I'm sorry that I lost it. This is how I would have liked to manage and I would have liked to respond.
I still don't know what I should have done in that moment.
And it's a learning thing, right?
And I think it was for all of us, to be honest. I think she was quite shocked. And I'm like, well, do you know what? Sometimes it's quite good for you to see just, how impactful your behaviour can be on other people and how they feel. But yeah, I was really, really ashamed of myself. But what I would say is that was very much a one-off. I think I've been that angry probably 3 times in her life. Mm. But if you are growing up in a home where people are very quick to anger and there's an undercurrent of threat or violence in the worst case scenarios, that really must influence a child's, and as they grow up, their way of dealing with anger and disappointment. I mean, and then to then recognize that in yourself must be very, very challenging, because that is your norm.
Yeah, absolutely. And the child in some ways learns that this is how I deal with anger, or this is how I deal with frustration, or this is an appropriate way to deal with disappointment. And I think that anger, frustration, disappointment, all these kind of like unpleasant, sometimes we label them as bad emotions, are normal emotions, they're valid emotions, and they should be expressed. And it's important that parents as well as children are able to express these emotions. If you're growing up in an environment where you're shushed all the time, like shush, you suppress these emotions. And like all emotions are to be expressed.
Yeah, it'll come out somehow.
Exactly, it'll come out somehow. It'll come out when you maybe involuntarily and you feel like you've lost control. So being able to speak to your children and help them understand that you will experience a range of emotions in response to a range of triggers, and it's okay to express these emotions. These are appropriate ways in which you can express emotions. And as a parent, if you're learning, that's okay. Share that learning experience with your child.
Dr. Bissy with us today, psychologist from Sage Clinics. So if you've got any questions for her, and as I said, we are going to be talking about anger in more general terms after 5:30. But just to come back to the angle on this regarding sports, the link between sport events and a spike in domestic violence cases. Now, recently we spoke to an organisation in Bahrain talking about common forms of domestic abuse reported at Shamsaha, and this is Fatima Al-Haddad sharing what they are hearing from the region.
The abuse that we see is emotional abuse, and it is something that not all people speak about. We're used to hearing, when we hear the term abuse or violence, automatically we think about physical, something that is seen. So what we see is that whenever someone is going through something and it's emotional or psychological, they wouldn't think that this is something that they can speak about, or they would feel that if they come forward, people will not believe them. However, we've opened this platform for people to approach us and let them know that they are not alone. So I would say emotional abuse is one of the most form of abuse that we see before physical abuse. Physical abuse is the second form.
One of the big questions that we had when we spoke to Fatima was this idea of why can't victims leave their situations, is what she had to say.
We understand that domestic violence is a cycle, and violence in general is a cycle, especially when it's faced, like if you are, it's between intimate partner, it's always hard to leave. So the cycle is that, you know, sometimes it will be small tensions that's building up, and she will start to feel like she doesn't have anyone, and he would start to, there's some explosion that will happen until something big just explodes, where he would start hitting or he would be abusive in a verbal way or anything. And then after that, there will be the honeymoon phase, and he'll give her gifts and he'll tell her, I'll change, just to get her back into the cycle that he wants her to be in. So it is never easy to actually leave the situation.
Fatima Al-Haddad speaking there. Now, I do just want to flag this. It is a 24/7 crisis support, so around the clock, multilingual crisis helpline. If you do want details of that, you can literally just send me the word help. I will send you the website so you can find out more about what Shamsaha do, some of the resources, and obviously contact them if you need to. No questions asked, no name needed. We are talking about domestic abuse, but opening up a little bit when we come to talk about anger next. Dr. Bissa is with us today. Clinical psychologist. We're going to be talking about strategies, the way to mitigate anger, and of course, we've got some questions on the text line.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
Joining us in studio today to talk about anger and misplaced anger in light of that report out of the UK talking about domestic violence incidents increase by up to 38% when England's national football side loses a game. And actually, in case of a draw or a win, there's still a 26% spike in domestic violence cases. We have got from Sage Clinics, clinical psychologist, Dr. Bissy Lanyon. And text lines are open 4001 if you're struggling with your own anger issues, or indeed there's someone in your life that you could do with some help with approaching, navigating, living with, working with, then do please reach out. I've also had a number of you asking for details of Shamsaha, which is an organisation out of Bahrain. And this is Fatima Al-Haddad talking about some of the services that they offer, just so you know.
Anyone that's facing domestic violence or sexual violence across the region can reach out to us. We have a 24/7 available support via our application. You can find us on Instagram and download our application from there. And a trained volunteer, trained crisis advocate volunteer, will be able to respond to you. Now, once you download the app, you can choose to either engage in Arabic or English, and then it will connect you to a volunteer that will be able to support you. Whether you're facing any kind of violence, any kind of domestic violence, they will be able to support you in any way or form.
If you want details of that website, the app, the crisis centre, just send me the word help on the app or indeed the WhatsApp. No questions asked, no name needed. I'll be very happy to send that your way. So, Dr. Bissy, let's talk anger. We talked before about how as kids we kind of learn how to navigate some of these big emotions by seeing what our parents do when they're feeling frustrated, disappointed, angry. What I find quite interesting is why some people are triggered easily by things when others might remain calm in that same situation. And I think parenting is a really interesting example of this. My kids can do something and I'm like, my son will be like, rah! I'm like, I find it, and then vice versa. Why are some people, and I also think we kind of overuse the word triggered, but I really do mean it in this situation where it can lead to someone, you know, really losing their temper. How important is it to understand what triggers you and understand the root of it?
It is extremely important because different things trigger different people, and the response to the trigger also depends and also varies. I think they're individual differences. So we have like our temperament and we also have our personality that can make us, as well as parenting and our experiences, that can make us more susceptible to expressing some of these anger or expressing some of these emotions in particular ways. Someone who's just a bit more relaxed and more laid back and more calm might experience anger, but they're able to deal with it internally. Whereas maybe someone who's a bit more extroverted might express that maybe more vocally.
Dramatically.
Exactly. Or more dramatically. Exactly. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it's inappropriate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. That's interesting. I wanted to put this question to you. It's an anonymous message that came in earlier saying, I went to stay with my parents recently and with my adult head on, I was shocked. My dad has some serious anger issues and gets mad over the smallest thing. It's been going on for years, but it seems much worse now. If he drops something, he shouts and swears. He mutters under his breath, throws things around. He bangs things on his head. He loses his temper, slams doors and sulks. My mum ignores it, doesn't say anything. I honestly don't know how to address it or if there's any point. He's 66 now. Mm. So I guess it's not a specific question as such, but I think it does leads that question of, is it possible for someone to completely change their way of expressing anger? And if so, what does that process look like? Because I would guess that needs to come from this dad saying, I'm not happy about how I'm interacting with the world and the people that I love and I want to change. But I don't actually get that impression from that message at all.
Yeah. You would be surprised, Helen, that some people aren't aware of how they are responding and the impact that it has.
And how they, their tone, their mannerisms are perceived by others.
Absolutely. And one thing that I actually want to highlight, especially when it comes to men, is the link between depression and anger. And sometimes anger is actually depression masked.
Really?
Yeah. So,
well, we think about anger being kind of a secondary emotion, really. Mm. You know, and what's under that anger? Is it depression, rejection, yeah, hurt?
That's why it's important to understand your triggers, mm-hmm, and understand what you're actually responding to or what's causing this anger. Is it the fact that you didn't put the butter knife where you're supposed to put it? Or is it the fact that you feel undermined in this house?
Yeah, I don't feel respected because you didn't, you know, request my wish to do that, yeah, last time you did that.
Absolutely.
That's really interesting. But the depression aspect, is that more so the case in men than women, the depression, anger link?
So we find that men can express this kind of like increased irritability and anger when they are depressed, whereas women are more likely to express this kind of like sense of like hopelessness or this sense of apathy. And again, it goes back to societal and cultural, mm, expectations and rules and norms of what's appropriate for a man to express versus what's appropriate for a woman to express. So if we are able to identify that actually it is a depression and then we're working to manage that, then we're more likely to see less of these explosive anger outbursts.
Really interesting. Dr. Yeah. Bissy with us today. We've had a message asking about any red flags in relationships so you can avoid men who have anger issues and maybe controlling issues too. And ultimately, what are some strategies for helping people address and manage their anger? We've had someone who's worried about losing their temper over the school holidays talking about triggers there.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
I think this is a really good question that's come in, Doctor, saying, can your experts share any red flags to look for early in a relationship to avoid men who do have anger issues and possibly controlling issues too? What comes to mind? If your best mate introduced you to a guy she was dating, what would you be looking for?
Interesting. I think that sometimes it can be difficult to pick out the red flags from that one meeting, but I will listen out to some of the patterns.
Consistency.
Yes, consistency, exactly what they're saying about this person. How does that person make you feel? When you're around that person, do you feel on edge? Do you feel that there are certain things that you can't say? There are certain ways that you can't dress? There are certain things about your personality or some views that you have to keep hidden? That says a lot, because mm-hmm, intimate relationships should actually create a safe space for us to be ourselves and to be authentic. And if you're in a relationship that hinders that, then for me, that is an orange turning into a potentially red flag. Then
amber,
exactly. And then think about things like such as the way they speak to you, their tone. In terms of like psychological and emotional abuse, things like playing mind games, gaslighting, making you doubt yourself, even making horrible remarks to you and then passing it off as a joke. That's not kind. Mm-hmm. And that to me would be a red flag. And also how they treat others.
Great answer. Yeah. Great answer. Where were you when I was dating in like 2009? I wanted to ask you lastly about resources. We just heard there from Shamsara about Bahrain, that 24-hour crisis line. Just to come back to why we're talking about anger today, this huge spike we see in the UK in particular, which is where the data is coming from, when football team loses, 38% spike, but also when they win or draw, 26% spike. What about here in the region? What resources, which services are available to those who might need it, Dr. Bissi?
Yes, I think it's important to highlight that they're actually laws. So both federal law and also Sharia law that is against domestic violence, and that comes with imprisonment and fines. But then also in terms of services, so you can contact the Dubai Foundation for Women and Children. Shall I share their number?
Absolutely.
Their number's 800-111. And if somebody that you know is in at imminent risk or you're at imminent risk, call the police. Go to the hospital. The police are there to safeguard, to protect you. And if you're in a relationship where you feel unable to contact services, go to a friend's house. You can also come to our clinic and make the calls and think about a safety plan to protect you and also your family.
Just to recap something we've discussed on the show before with Madeline Mendy, family lawyer, when it comes to physical abuse, if you do want to, you will need that logged.
Yeah.
Rashid Hospital is the one you need to go to.
Absolutely.
You don't need to press any charges at that point, but in terms of getting any physical evidence, photographs, etc., Rashid Hospital is the one to go to. Anything else we should flag?
Yes. There are more services. Shall I just give you a list of the services?
Yeah, that'd be okay.
Yeah, I'll give you a list of the services.
Do you know what? Let's do that. Dr. Bissi, you can send that to me. If anyone wants to send me the word help, we can get that out on a message. As I said, absolutely no questions asked, no name needed. And I think it's really important to know that you've got places to go, that you've got people to talk to.
Absolutely.
And whether that's, you know, professionally, psychologically, but also, you know, in terms of government protection as well.
Yes.
Thank you, Dr. Bissi.
Thank
really,
you so much.
Really appreciate it. Clinical psychologist speaking to us from Sage Clinics.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
On Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
His Highness Sheikh Hamdan bin Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, the Crown Prince of Dubai, has recently announced plans to, quote, upskill all teachers in the Emirate in artificial intelligence. It is in line with Dubai's plans to accelerate the adoption of AI applications. What do we think that could look like in practice? Is there a place for AI in the classroom? Dr. Neil Hopkin with us today. He leads the academic leadership team at Fortis Education. Do you use AI yourself, sir?
I do use AI, Helen.
Do you like a bit of ChatGPT?
I do like a bit of ChatGPT. I'm surrounded by colleagues that use a lot more than I do. And I think in my job, it is largely around text and communicating and those kind of things, as opposed to perhaps different applications. But I'm never really more amazed than when I see a young child connecting two or three bits of AI together to produce something as an outcome. And I'm very definitely not at that level of competence.
Here would be my worry, strictly between us. I was quite a lazy student and quite a deceptive teenager. Let's just say I think AI would have been in the wrong hands when I was probably doing my A-levels.
Well, I mean, you're not alone with that kind of worry. And I think we've seen this, especially on the other side of the pond in the States, that as soon as sort of 18 months ago now, AI hit our consciousness as people on the street, there was a great deal of concern amongst American schools in the US about cheating. And they were absolutely convinced that every child was going to teach and was going to be able to fool the system and get a better grade. And of course, over time, we've proven that that is the case. Not that the children teach, but that actually AI is able to get better grades than the average child can get.
There was something actually just in the UK universities last week. It was a chatbot outperforming students.
Exactly. And we're just at the start of this journey with AI. So I think the challenge that lies in front of schools and in front of universities is much more profound. It's to say, if you're still testing your children in ways that those children can use tools, just as you and I use calculators rather than slide rules,
then actually...
So if the children are able to leverage these new tools of AI, then actually your test is wrong. You're testing the wrong things and you're still thinking in a system that actually was probably more appropriate for 30 years ago rather than today.
So Dr. Neil, can you then give us a bit of an overview of what the new AI training initiative for teachers in Dubai is going to look like? And what do you think prompted its inception?
Well, I think, I imagine that there was a great deal of high-level talk about where the UAE wanted to position itself in terms of AI and really innovation generally. And there was a determination to make sure that actually what's known as the Dubai Universal Blueprint for AI, which is clever, isn't it? Dubai, it's spelled.
It's just clicked with me.
Is an attempt to make sure that the workforce here and everybody is prepared, not only for today and for tomorrow, but for 5 years and 10 years time. And I think what we've been able to see is that over the course of the last 18 months, AI has moved incredibly rapidly, sometimes perhaps not always in a great way. So we saw that moment, didn't we, when OpenAI revealed that their new speaking AI bot sounded suspiciously like Scarlett Johansson,
who had been approached, by the way, about voicing it and had said no.
And then suddenly there it is. I mean, obviously that was something of a faux pas or a very unfortunate coincidence. However, what was problematic with it was that it actually seemed to personify AI in a certain way and women in a certain way. And so just as we now shout at our phones, and I won't shout it in case it sets your phone off, but we say to our phones and command for it to find me that restaurant or show me the way to XYZ particular place. And if the AI response is a female voice, then all of these young children growing up start to form some stereotypes about how people might speak and how other people might respond in a certain way. So I think that AI is certainly developing very rapidly, not always in a good way, and we need to have some reins. However, in the UAE, we're determined to do all of that ethical thinking, all of the rigor that needs to go into
and
that.
Be proactive about
it. Be proactive and get on the front foot and become an epicenter for this globally.
I mean, the train has left the station. It's like, are we going to be on it or not? I just want to say, by the way, when I do use ChatGPT, I do say please and thank you. I am not an animal, okay?
That's very nice. I would have expected nothing.
Well, I just feel like I'm going to get a better quality of response. Now, I was listening to a podcast this morning, which is actually an entertainment podcast, and it was talking about the first AI-generated script of a feature film has been made. So this is really interesting. It's a director called Louisa who has gave a 17-word prompt to, I think it was ChatGPT, to say, create me a feature-length script about a scriptwriter who was worried about being outperformed by a chatbot. It took 4 days for the script to come out. The script has now been turned into a movie that has obviously been acted in by people. It's been lit by humans. And it's going to be really interesting. I think the point is, it's not about replacing society scriptwriters, but it's like, this is available now. What can this look like? Well, let's dip our toe in. Let's see where we're at in terms of quality and application. Because it is going to be coming for a few jobs, for sure. But not being threatened by it, using it kind of in hand. I think that's been a bit of a concern for people going, if we're talking about more AI in the classroom, does that mean less human interaction, less, you know, emotive teaching, more screens?
I think it probably means the opposite of all of that. I think that introducing AI into the classroom in some way actually liberates the teacher. It takes the burden off their shoulders of some of the mundane tasks. We can remember.
Same for medical teams as well.
It is.
You know, paperwork and.
I think we'll find this across industries. I mean, clearly there was a problem earlier this year, wasn't there, in terms of script writing, for instance, just to follow your story through there, that is problematic. But I think that's a moment in time when particular industries find themselves in this inflection point when actually they're changing from one era into another era. And I think in the fullness of time, we'll see that all industries change to start to take on board these tools. When calculators were first introduced in schools, teachers were walking around on the streets with placards, maths teachers, obviously, and so they were disheveled and had leather patches on their elbows. But they were marching around saying, don't let the calculator in the classroom, because they were very concerned that actually children would stop stop understanding how to multiply or do long division. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, as time has progressed, we still teach those things because it's important for children to have an understanding and a grounding in that basis. But we don't spend all of our time waiting there, and we understand that there's a powerful tool here, and that actually we can advance the children's intelligence if we use that tool. I think the same thing will happen, just as you said, is happening in the medical profession, mm-hmm. And it is happening within education, that actually we're seeing that we can lift some of the burden of some of the more menial tasks off the shoulders of the teachers, so actually they can spend more time interacting with your child and personalize that child's learning journey even better.
If you've got any questions, any concerns, or any, are you looking forward to this chapter? We have got in the studio from Fortis Education, the head of the academic leadership team, Dr. Neil Hopkin. I'm kind of intrigued to talk next. There is a competition involved in this initiative we've been talking about. And I guess, you know, what steps can parents take as well? We need to talk to our children about critical thinking, about the ethics of AI.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
In conversation now about education with Dr. Neil Hopkin. He leads the academic leadership team at Fortis Education, and we're talking about this directive about upskilling all teachers in the Emirate in artificial intelligence. Now, I am not a teacher. It was not my calling. I do not have the patience. So when we're talking there about what that is going to look like, and you know, we're still waiting for details. It's only been a very recent announcement. What are some of the benefits, some of the challenges to using AI, and what do you think are some of the very real life applications that we can expect to see in our classrooms, Dr. Neil?
Well, at Fortis Education, we have been working on this for a year. We have a whole team of leading academics that are thinking and experimenting. And it's very much at that stage, I think, probably for most schools around the world, that we're really experimenting with things. And of course, some things work really well and some things don't work as well. Mm-hmm. Some things offer opportunities and others perhaps offer maybe some, not dangers, but some downsides. And I think the best example for me is something that I saw produced by a brilliant colleague of mine who leads it for us at St Mark's School called Richard Bishop. And he developed this little bot within ChatGPT, so a sort of a walled garden of AI that was able to take in a scanned piece of work from a child's writing, looked at the national curriculum and compared the outcomes for that, and to make an analysis of the kinds of points that the child had managed to hit there in terms of the mark schemes for examinations. Wow. And was to give some recommendations about areas that they could work on. Now, that's a brilliant thing to be able to do. And of course, it enables the child to work more independently and to be more proactive in terms of how they're engaging with their work. The downside to it, if it was implemented that way, would be, of course, that ChatGPT could then make some assessments about what grade the child had got and mm-hmm. not actually be accurate.
Well, there's that, and there's also this idea of how well should a teacher know a child and their work? You know, how familiar should you be about their progress and their concerns and their limits and their insecurities?
I think that brings us back to a point which is much larger than AI, which is how much time do you want your child to spend on a screen or to be interacting with a computer? And mm-hmm. often we hear within education that, look, teachers, don't worry that AI isn't going to take your job because it will never be able to replace people in terms of empathy and creativity and so on. But actually, we can see that that isn't true. There are already bots that are empathizing and millions of conversations are happening between children and friendship bots, which in itself is a problem and I think in a great cause of concern for all of us.
Chills, it really does.
But also, we can see that AI can be very creative, not always accurately and not always in the way that you intended, but it's able to do that. I think actually what we want to see in classrooms that AI won't be able to overcome is actually interaction from one human to another, mm-hmm. and that demonstration of values and attitudes. For that, the teacher is always going to be absolutely necessary. So I think, as with all things, AI and computers more generally and screen time, moderation is key. Mm-hmm. I don't think it should be all pervasive. I think it should be a tool that is used with a surgeon's accuracy in terms of what we want to do in terms of children's learning. But at the same time, it should have its place, just like every other tool within the classroom.
So a complementary tool. But it's funny to come back to that point about your colleague in terms of personalising a student's learning experience, especially, you know, in parts of the world where perhaps teaching resources are, you know, lacking, you know, where the numbers, the ratios aren't just stacking up in a way that, you know, we're lucky enough to have here. I wondered, there is a competition aspect to this announcement with a significant monetary award. We're still waiting to hear full details, but do we know what people are going to be looking for about innovation and use of AI in the classroom?
We do. We know that over the course of the next couple of terms in the new academic year, working towards a celebration from organised by Dubai's Centre for Artificial Intelligence towards the end of April of 2025, we know that they're going to be looking for teachers that are working on particular aspects, and that might be scalability. How can you find a clever way of using AI and scale it across your school or across your group of schools or to your friends around the world? They're looking, of course, for creativity and originality in terms of their ideas that people might be using. They're also looking for collaboration. So people that are actually able to step outside of their box and outside of their little walled perimeter into their neighbours' schools and so on, and work collectively together. The real idea behind trying to incentivize people to do this is to make sure that across the UAE, everybody is moving forward and every parent and every business owner is aware that actually our young children are on the move and they're AI ready and they're actually already skilled at leveraging AI to work on other projects.
Dr. Neil, can I ask you to put your dad hat on for a second?
Yes.
Would that be all right?
Yeah, I will.
Any parental concerns about screens, AI in the classroom, and ultimately how are you preparing your kids to work with some of these technologies to carry them through not just education, but perhaps career paths and journeys too?
Yeah, so I think from a parent's perspective, there are always concerns about screen time. We know that the apps
summer coming, I'm already like, oh.
It is a problem. Gosh. So we know that, I mean, some parents don't parent particularly well and they use a device as
a digital nanny.
A digital nanny. And I think that's very destructive and should be something that parents look at themselves very hard in the mirror about. But equally, the devices themselves, even if you're being very judicious as a parent, the device and the apps in actual fact that the device is running very often are addictive. We understand that.
They're
understood
that
gaming
way.
For a certain. It's like sugar, isn't it? And getting that dopamine hit and those kind of things that really have an impact. And so our job as parents and as educators in schools is to make sure that, first of all, devices have their place. And we'll come on to an aspect of that around bullying in a moment. Mm-hmm. But devices have their place within the learning, the legitimate learning environment of the classroom.
And pandemic, we know, just accelerated that probably more
it did
than
indeed.
We would have expected.
It did indeed. And we need to keep them in their place and have them used usefully. There should be an array of tools that we tend to use. And I would want to see that my child's school is actually doing that. My child's school is doing that. My children are at Sunmark School. And so I know that that Andrea Higgins, the head of primary there, is looking very hard at how much time children are spending on screens. But you would want to make sure that your school was doing that if they hadn't notified you of that already. But on top of that, I think there's also this element of understanding that a device itself, looking at a screen, focusing your eyes at a close distance, looking at that particular quality of light beyond a certain time of the day, can affect your sleep patterns, it can affect your vision. There's a physiological aspect.
Yeah, circadian rhythms are wrecked.
My
daughter came into our room the other night at 9 o'clock saying, "I'm not tired," and I was like, and it was at the weekend, so they are allowed the devices at the weekend. We don't have no iPads during the week, but she'd been playing this Toca Boca game until about 7:30, and I was like, funny that, Phoebes.
And there you go. And I think the job that we have as parents is to make sure that our children learn to regulate that.
Yes.
That they learn to be in control. It's that whole issue, isn't it, of feeding somebody a fish or teaching them how to fish.
No, but then I need to look at my own behaviours.
Well,
big time. And I've really been thinking about this. I got my usage notification a couple of days ago and I was like, oh, that's a fair few hours I've been on my phone every day.
A large part of this is about parental behaviour. And there are many parents that are prepared to point the finger of blame anywhere else, at the child, at the child's school, and so on. But actually, a child spends more time with their parents than they do in school when you look at the entirety of the year. And so really, where are their behaviours coming from? Mostly they're coming from your genes and from your behaviour. Mm-hmm. The first book that any child reads is you. We've talked about this previously, about about reading. And it's very true in terms of behavior. And so if you're not present with your child, if you're not putting your device down, if you allow an adult or a teenager perhaps to have a phone at the dinner table, and younger children are seeing that, they're reading and understanding that that is okay behavior. And it's not okay to say, but mummy's really, but this is just a work thing.
It's just a work thing. Neil Hopkins got the hidden cameras in the farmer household. But I think it's that kind of mixed blessing of being able to work from anywhere. It means you can work from anywhere, which is what we're going to be talking about. Last question, Dr. Neil, what conversations do you think we'll be having in 5-10 years time about AI in the classroom? Will we be calling it AI?
I don't think we'll be calling it AI. I think it will be something that's de rigueur in every classroom. Mm-hmm. And we will see that there are massive benefits to having AI augmenting learning. We will be much more seasoned in our understanding of the importance of humanity and connecting. We'll be much more developed in our thinking about project-based learning and design thinking, and how actually that higher order level of metacognition, helping children to find problems in the world and solve them, all of that is actually enabled and empowered by AI. We will be in charge of AI, not AI in charge of us.
Well, might play that clip out in 5 years' time when the AI bot is reading out my script for me.
We'll see.
Dr. Neil, thank you so much for your
time.
It's lovely
to see
you. Really, really appreciate it. From Fortis Education, Dr. Neil Hopkin. We're continuing with education actually after 12:30, talking about reclassification of higher education here in the UAE. Four groups have been established categorising the universities. So what do we need to know, and what are some of the benefits to students and parents alike?
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
On Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
Continuing our discussions around education this afternoon, the Ministry of Education has recently launched the National Higher Education Institutions Classification Framework. Bit of a mouthful. This is about strengthening the UAE's global position as an epicentre for higher education. We're going to be talking about the categories, what they mean, benefits that parents and students need to know about. And joining us live on the line is Her Excellency Dr. Samira Al-Mullah, the Acting Assistant Undersecretary for the Curriculum Sector and the Director of Certificate Equivalency Department at the Ministry of Education, to give us all the details to understand how, yes, the universities, but also the students can benefit from this framework. Doctor, how are you today? Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Helen. I'm fine, alhamdulillah.
Thank you so much for your time today and really unpacking what this means, because what we're talking about is a number of different categories for universities here in the UAE. Would you mind explaining the main differences between the two categories? There's a research cluster and a non-research cluster. Would you mind explaining what those mean and who falls into them?
Yes. So first of all, maybe you stated very rightfully, Helen, that this classification, the results of the classification, is to help the students and parents to select the right university as per the desire of the students to continue their education and even to draw their future path in the labor market. Mm-hmm. So going back to the question about the research and non-research, in the United Arab Emirates, we have around 73 universities that are licensed by Ministry of Education. Those universities, if they are delivering bachelor and postgraduate programs like master and PhD, then they are considered under the research cluster. If the university has only diploma or bachelor degrees, then they will be categorized under the non-research cluster.
Okay. So I want to get into the four groups as well, if you don't mind, Dr. Samira, yes, because the university has been classified based on four pillars. Can you explain those four pillars, please?
Yes. So the classification framework actually consists of four pillars. So it's research innovation, and employment and relevance to the labor market. Then we have students' life, teaching and student life, and finally internationalization. So these are main pillars, or these are the four pillars that consisted of the based on which the ranking, the scoring will be calculated. Under each pillar, there are quite good number of indicators. Based on these indicators, again, it will eventually help us to calculate the pillar weights per university.
So if I'm just trying to put myself in the position of a parent who maybe has a 16 or 17 year old here in the UAE and they want to stay for university. Can you explain how this framework will be used by teachers, by parents, by students to help them identify which institution is the best fit for them, Doctor?
Yeah, this is one of the most important questions that everyone should ask when they see these results. For example, if I'm as a student, I want to join a university where the employment rate of their graduate is very high. Mm-hmm. Then the classification results will help me to identify those universities. On the other hand, me as a parent, if I was concerned about universities that are very high in research and very active in research, then I might prefer for my kids or for my children to join a university that's highly ranked in the research and innovation pillar. Mm-hmm. So besides the overall ranking of the universities in research cluster, we are also, the information, by the way, it's already available on the Ministry of Education website, where the students and the parents, even the labor markets, if they want to know, for example, if I am, let's say, a space industry and I would like to collaborate with universities with high research impact, then I might consider looking for the universities under the research pillar. Mm-hmm. So we announce the overall ranking, like the universities will be in one of the four groups of the results, like group one, group two, group three, and group four. And then another classification or another type of, let's say the presentation of the results will be based on the pillar. So what are the those four groups per pillar, like in research and innovation, what are the universities under group one, what are the universities in group two, and so on and so forth.
Got you. I have to say, you know, incredible roster of universities here in the UAE. What are your predictions for the next couple of years when it comes to students coming in or retaining students here in the UAE, even new openings? What are your predictions, Doctor?
Yeah, so the main component based on which this classification framework was built is the transparency. And the main objective is to maintain the quality and improve the quality of higher education in the UAE. And when you have those two components, it will be the institutes in the or the universities in the UAE will be more attractive for collaboration with highly ranked universities outside the UAE, and also it can be more attractive for students, talented students who want to join the universities inside the UAE.
Doctor, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Really interesting time to think about. Obviously, a lot of people moving to the UAE, wanting to stay here, and education being such a key part of it. So fascinating to hear about these pillars just what the future holds. Joining us from the Ministry of Education, Her Excellency Dr. Samira Al-Mulla.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Today, really excited to introduce you to our guest. Janine Sudbury is with us, a renowned leadership coach with a few decades of experience in the field. She's pioneered a really unique approach to leadership development by incorporating, wait for it, I didn't get a sound effect done in time, horses, into those workshops. She's worked with some really high-profile figures such as Silver Fern Coach, All Black Coach as well, Steve Hansen, and numerous high-level CEOs. And she's here in Dubai working in particular with Dubai's female CEOs, talking about this method, offering something different, but offering some wisdom to us on the show as well today. Janine, how are you?
I am fine and dandy, thank you. It's wonderful to be back. I used to work at the BBC in radio and national radio in New Zealand. And, you know, this is really my happy place behind the microphone.
No microphone tutoring needed for you, which is what we often do. We like, sit here and, you know, come a bit closer, because what we find quite a lot, if someone's a bit nervous in the studio, the natural reaction is to go and move themselves back from the microphone. So I'm happy that you're here and I'm happy you're at ease here. And great to have you in the city as well.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about your history with Dubai. How many times have you been in, and how do you feel like your perception of the city has changed over the years?
Well, I've only actually been once, and that was in December. And I think it's the start of a love story, to be honest.
Wow.
I came to Dubai and I thought, okay, now I know why everyone is raving about this place. It was fabulous.
And I think the female aspect is particularly pertinent. I mean, you're plugged in with the Female Fusion Group, and some of the stories of, you know, entrepreneurship, leadership, success, struggles that people are sharing are just incredible. So I think that's what I wanted to kind of talk to you today about, in particular about this idea of a leadership and maybe how the concept and even our perception of that word has changed in the last, you know, you've been working this for 20 years now, Janine. Tell us a little bit about what that word means to you.
Well, when I first started doing leadership programs, I wasn't really sure. And even now, I think everybody's perception of what leadership means is different. So I have developed this unique training program. It's a 14-week program, and it starts, as you mentioned earlier, starts with 2 days with the horses.
Why?
Why? Exactly why? Well, loads of good reasons why horses, and why not say dogs or goldfish or whatever. So the reason I love to use horses is because they're so honest. They give you really blunt and immediate feedback on your leadership style. And the reason they can do this is because they're herd animals and they're always looking for a leader, but they won't just follow anyone. You have to be sending out all the right body messages. You have to be authentic. In the words of that great thought leader, Ali G, you've got to keep it real.
And the horses.
And the horses, that's
they,
right.
They
and
can
the
see through it.
They know when you're faking. But, and so they're giving you this feedback, and then you can sort of make the necessary changes in real time.
But isn't that interesting that there is this idea of what a leader should be, of this very kind of stereotypical, often male, persona.
Yeah.
And sometimes men take on that persona as well because they feel like it's being projected onto them. And then often trying to be a leader in a way that feels authentic to you is a real barrier because it's like, well, this wasn't what I wasn't raised to think of myself as a leader or how a more feminine leadership style can be really effective.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely the point that so many of my female leaders ask me. How do we bring ourselves to work? One said, look, I cry when I'm stressed. What do I do? And I said, you know what? Don't try and copy anyone else. Mm. It's all about bringing you to work. And if you're going to have a cry, just say, please excuse me for a moment. I'm feeling emotional. Have your cry in the toilet, then come back. But don't try and copy someone else. It literally just doesn't work.
And it's exhausting. Better to be a first-rate version of yourself than
absolutely
a second-rate version of someone else. And I, for what it's worth, I cry. And it's something I thought, I'm in my 40s now, I thought that when I would get to a certain age, maturity, that when I didn't feel frustrated or slighted, that I would be able to kind of keep it cool. But no, it just seems to be, and it's so frustrating because I feel like it completely underwhelms whatever point I'm trying to make, professionally or personally, especially in with my husband as well. And I'm like, oh no, he's got the upper hand here because I've just cried. But it's me, it's who I am. It's how I,
it's
you know,
you
connect with people and,
yeah,
you know. So let's come back to this. Let's come back to the leadership piece because what are some of the common challenges that people are coming to you with saying, you know, I'm in a role or I've started a company and it's not clicking for me. What are the pain points that women in particular are coming to you with, Janine?
Well, certainly with women. I mean, women are so wonderful to work with. They're so empathetic. You know, that is our strength as women. However, the barriers to success for many women that I work with is people-pleasing syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the inability to really stick to your values and standards because you're afraid, really. You're fearful of not being liked or not having approval or being told you're bossy or aggressive. That is a real problem. And another problem that I find in, I would say, sort of 100% of the women actually is imposter syndrome.
For anyone who's not familiar with that syndrome, and let me tell you, I very much am. How do you describe what that is and what can that look like in how you're feeling and even behaviours that you might be kind of exhibiting?
It's very common in perfectionists and it exhibits in people thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to be found out soon. Somebody's going to clock me for not really belonging here. I don't deserve this success. It's all those sort of little voices going through your head. And there's lots of really good ways of overcoming imposter syndrome.
Tell me them all.
Well, one of them is to work with a horse. You can't have imposter syndrome when you're working with a horse.
You didn't even bring one to the studio,
Janine. I'm sorry,
Janine.
I could have brought a pantomime horse, but I thought your listeners might not understand what was going on.
Could have done a Facebook Live, but we're going to talk more a little bit about bringing your authentic self to work next.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
On Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
We are talking about what horses can teach you that humans can't with Janine Sudbury today. She's a leadership coach with over 25 years experience. She's built her own successful businesses, has overcome self-doubt to pursue opportunities and now inspire other people in a very unique way. Let's talk more about the horses. And I'm asking you in a kind of, please demystify this for me, Janine. You said it's a 14-week program that you're doing. You're running sessions here in Dubai over the next few days, and you're going to be back in December for more leadership coaching. With the horses, I'm just trying to picture it. What happens? Can you literally just talk it out for me?
It's like a dating app for horses. So I can only take 10 leaders at one time for 2 days. Now this is not a Mickey Mouse tree huggy exercise. This is the real deal. This is the toughest leadership program you can ever go on. That's why it gets the results. It's transformational. And I matchmake human and horse. And then what happens is the human has to learn how to lead the horse. And the horse is thinking, hang on a minute, I'm not going to follow you. And they have to do some very simple looking exercise. At least I make it look simple. Mm-hmm. Now, if you employ 7 principles of the horse whisperer, those are my principles. If you employ them, and they're quite simple principles, but people often think they understand how to build, for example, good relationships. But until they've faced with a horse and they have to build a relationship quickly to get the horse to follow them, that's how they really get an in-depth understanding of what these 7 leadership principles really mean in action. And I think this is the key. This is about acting leadership. This is not a simulation. This is not a role play. This mm-hmm. is the real deal. If you don't get that horse to follow you, it all looks a bit embarrassing. It's very, very confronting. And to make matters worse, I'm videoing this. And we have 3 video analysis sessions. And if you think the horses are blunt, you haven't met me yet.
Do you have people that have come in and they've read all the leadership books and they are playing a role?
Yeah.
And
oh, God, yeah, absolutely. Okay. So I've had people, for example, I've had the head of the Dressage New Zealand Olympic coach come and do it. I've had top horse people. I've had people who've been to every leadership program in Australasia. They're no better. Mm-hmm. This is really something so out of the box, and this is where true leadership takes root.
Let's go to the text line. A message here from Eugenia, who says she's really intrigued about a day with you tomorrow. So that's going to be interesting.
I'm looking forward to meeting you.
And Ritwick saying, lovely topic, leadership and its many nuances. Key one for me, leadership starts with listening. And by that, I mean actual active listening. For that leads to a better people management and a better workplace. You're nodding along.
Yeah, I am, because, you know, just spoiled one of my principles there.
Tell
one
us.
Of them is communication. And, you know, people think communication is about you telling other people stuff. It's not actually. It's about, as you were correctly announced there, it's about listening and it's about making sure you've been understood. Mm. And as I mentioned, relationships is key, and relationships impact on how you present that information and how you've made sure you've been understood. And with the horses, it's really easy because they blink their eyes and they lick their lips and they might lower their head and they might even sigh. So we can very quickly tell if we've been understood when working with the horse. So what we've got to do is transfer those skills to humans. How do we make sure we've been understood? And that's something that we explore over the course of the 2 days.
Can I ask about limiting beliefs? And I'm talking about women in particular because you were touching on imposter syndrome. Mm. Someone who has found themselves in the leadership role, perhaps it's never been the ambition to be there, but work has taken it that way, or as we've seen, and thankfully because of, you know, licensing and visas here in the UAE post-pandemic, people starting their own businesses, and maybe they'd be more successful than they'd imagined, but they've got this nagging voice of, I'm not good at that. Mm. My CEO doesn't feel like a hat I want to wear. How do you help people overcome that?
I think you help them, or how I help them, is by when they go through the process with the horse, they realise that they can do really, really difficult things, things that they never, ever thought at the start of the 2 days they would be able to do. In fact, if I spoke to another horse trainer and said, look, I take this bunch of people who may be scared of horses or never dealt with a horse, and by the end of it, they're taking them over these really challenging obstacles, it would be poo-pooed. I'd be accused of lying. So firstly, it's about taking yourself out of your comfort zone, releasing yourself from fear, because it's the fear that holds so many women back. Now, if you can overcome the fear, you can do anything at all. There are also, by the way, some good hacks on overcoming imposter syndrome if you can't come with me on the two-day horse program. And those are things like keep a success diary. Everything you do that is really cool and you're really proud of, write it down. And when you're having one of those low moments, have a look and think, actually, no, I did win that contract. And so-and-so did send me, you know, some business and I did this really well.
Gina, I love that so much.
Do you?
I really do.
Do you have one?
No, of course I don't. I have a gratitude journal. At the end of it every day, I write three great things that happened. And that can literally be getting a good parking space, or it could be, you know, something professionally, or connection time with my kids, or, you know, whatever it might be. But, you know, writing on a post-it or sticking it in a jar or something, because we are, I and I know an awful lot of people are who are also busy, we're so quick to push past and rush past our accomplishments. It's always about what's next. Okay, great, I did that, but it wasn't good enough. Or,
yeah,
I mean, my eyes are focused on the next milestone, prize, you know, goal. And we do have down days, and sometimes we do kind of lose sight of what we have accomplished, whether that is in a short time or a long time. You know, I think so many of us can think back to 5 years and go, God, you know, I'd never thought I'd be here in 5 years' time. And we don't give ourselves enough credit, really.
No, I don't. I think that's true. And I think, you know, much kudos to all those people who've taken the risk to go and start their own business.
I would say kudos to anyone who's found themselves in a foreign, I mean, using the UA as an example. I've got so many friends here and they get hate from their friends back home going, oh, you're so lucky to live in Dubai. It's like, no, I took a risk. We took a risk to move here at 24 or 44, whatever that might be, to move to another country, to take a job, to build a life. And that takes guts. And we often don't give ourselves credit for that either.
And you know, courage is such a key word as a leader. And women who, and men and women who do that, who leave the comforts and the security of family to start a new adventure, you know, it does take courage. Mm-hmm. And to be a good leader, you need loads and loads of courage.
Would you mind just quickly recapping your seven principles of leadership? I know we're going to run out of time, and I've got people asking for where people can find out more about you.
Okay.
And I will share that in a minute.
Lovely. Well, I'm not going to tell you seven because I don't want to give it all away, but I will tell you two. Now, the first one is the foundational principle of build relationships. Learn how to build relationships quickly. And I can tell you how to do that. Not now, but I can tell you another time. And another one that's really, really important, especially for women, is your physical presence. Something you might never have thought of. It's how you present yourself. What does your body say? Do you slouch into a room? Is your body looking small? Do you look at the ground? Do you smile? There's so many easy hacks you can do to create an amazing first impression so that when you walk into that room, people are sitting up and thinking, wow, I want to get to know that person. Mm-hmm. And I do this quite a lot with a lot of women. And it's such an easy, quick thing that you can just practice at home in the mirror.
It would be a great thing to teach teenage girls as well.
Oh, definitely.
That's when it
and
starts.
And teenage boys, actually, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Bit more eye contact.
Yes, a lot of eye contact.
From all of us.
Maybe even the odd smile that goes out to my son.
Mother of a teenager, yeah. In the studio. Do you need me run out of time? Thank you so, so much. For people that are reaching out about the courses, about you, what's the best thing that I can share? And I will do that happily.
Yes, well, why don't you connect with me on LinkedIn? Janine Sudbury, Sudbury. My company, Impact Leadership. I'm based in New Zealand. I would love to connect with all you lot or anybody who's interested.
And you're coming back in December.
I'm coming back in December. I'm running a 2-day experiential workshop with the horses. I have 10 places. So if you're interested, get in touch with me and we can have a chat. And can I also say, if it's easier for you, please contact me through Female Fusion, because they're doing a great job of connecting me with entrepreneurs out here.
And you know what? To the women out there who are starting a business, looking to start a business, need advice, need support, it is an incredible network of warmth and experience. So, yeah, absolutely. Shout out to Female Fusion. Janine Sudbury, thank you so much for your time.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
So I did a little Instagram poll yesterday to find out, you know, amongst the people that follow me, who's here, who's staying, who's going. And 41% of respondents said they were leaving the UAE this summer for more than a month. And I actually wasn't surprised, because I've had an awful lot of conversations with people who might have their own business, maybe they're teachers, their partner might have a big element of flexible working built into their contract now post-pandemic. They're able to work remotely for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 6 weeks. So I wanted to speak to industry insider now, Awaz Ismail, director at Mark Ellis Recruitment and Training Academy, and a real expert when it comes to digital technology and the kind of financial technology, about remote working. So, you know, are you seeing people, when they're coming to you with a recruitment, you know, hat on, saying, I need flexibility, I need remote work, I need to be out of the UAE for a month? How prevalent is it?
Yeah, it's actually a trend that's increased over the past few years, especially post-COVID. You know, I think everybody got a trial to work remotely during COVID, and companies embrace this during the next few years, you know, and employees are getting used to that type of freedom or flexibility, you can say. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't mean it's always positive on both the employee side and the employer side. I speak to a lot of candidates who look for jobs who tell me, you know, I would rather not have remote working or flexible working, because it means that I actually end up working longer and harder. So
And do you think they are? Do you think if you were to toss up the quality of work and the number of hours, or is it just a bit of a perception because lines are blurred?
No, I think they actually are, because what tends to happen is, I mean, you're working in an office, you know, around 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, you're packing your bags and you're, you know, on your way home. When you're working from home, you're staying, you know, as long as you need to complete your task. Mm-hmm. And what you tend to do is potentially take longer during the day to complete tasks, which you might complete faster when you're at the office. So it kind of makes you work longer hours in the long run.
Yeah, I can well imagine that lack of compartmentalization can be a real issue. So what about the summer then? What are some key strategies for employees to work effectively from abroad, be that, I don't know, south of France, or, you know, the UK, or heading to Vietnam on a, you know, for a beach, while being productive, but then having a bit of work-life balance too?
Yeah, I think it's all about managing time appropriately. So one of the biggest things is it's something called the time blocking trend, which is basically an ability to block your time for a specific task that you need to complete throughout the day. Mm-hmm. So you know that from a certain time to a certain time, you need to do this particular task or this particular job. Once you're done, then you can, it's just like managing your day on a normal routine where you have your breaks and so on, but at home or on holiday or whatever you're going to be in the world.
The confusion often comes when there's family involved, which is, you know, I might be here, but I'm not really here. And we've all seen the videos of, you know, children careering into a home office in the background of a Zoom, or yeah. I guess this appointment, you know, we're having a day out, but you're staying at home today. Any ideas about kind of dealing with that softer side of, I know I'm here, but mum's a bit busy for the next 4 hours.
100% agree with you. So families don't often understand the pressure of remote work. So they think because you're at home, you know, that means you're home. Mm-hmm. And it kind of leads to conflicts and so on. But it's so important to actually set clear boundaries. So one of the things I would recommend is, if you are working from home or remotely, you should set up a place where you work and everybody knows that this is your, you know, workspace, dedicated workspace, you could say. That kind of sets a boundary from you and the family. And they know that when you're in this room or in the space you're working,
get a sign for the door. Do not disturb. Please clean this room. But I think even especially with kids, you know, being very clear with them and kind of demystifying a little bit about what our day. And I find that, you know, even with my kids when I'm here, is that, you know, I will be home at 6 o'clock and then I am all yours. So, you know, putting a schedule on the door saying, you know, lunch break from 1 until 2, you know, finish at 6, whatever that well, that might be. The yep. time difference can be a bit of a problem as well, though, I would imagine.
Correct.
You know, people getting up at, you know, 4 or 5 in the morning to be, you know, with UAE hours as well. What about boundaries with the boss and colleagues, you know, managing expectations and, you know, preventing a bit of even burnout, whether you're working remotely year round from home or indeed if you are doing that over the summer?
Yeah, so actually there was a study done by a place called Owl Labs a few years back, and it showed that people who work from home or remote tend to get burnt out quicker than people who work in the office. So, and that's only because of the fact that they're constantly being haggled, you can say, by their bosses or by their colleagues or peers and so on regarding work and regarding expectations. Everybody works in their own type of time, so they will call whenever they feel it's convenient. Again, it's all about setting, you know, the type strategy in terms of, or the right strategy, sorry, in terms of the timings that you're available, in mm-hmm. terms of making sure you communicate with your boss. You know, if you're in the UK and there's 3-hour time difference, they need to know that 9 a.m. in Dubai is 6 a.m. in the UK, so you're most likely going to be asleep. But you'll be available later during the day and later than they will be. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just about getting the work done. It's a double-edged sword from both the employer and the employee. The employer needs to have that commitment to give them the flexibility, but the employee also needs to understand that there's a business and there's, you know, things that need to be done, so they need to be done when they're due.
And communication as well, you know, and, you know, I'll say this to Milani, I'll send her an email at 10 o'clock at night and be like, do not reply to this until tomorrow, or I'll send her a WhatsApp and say, do not look at this until the morning. And I say it in a jokey way, but it can just be a case of, you know, just actioning this now, doesn't need your attention until tomorrow, you know, I'm going to be available from X time UAE or UK or US or whatever that might look like. So everyone is on the same page and no one's on call 24 hours a day. Which brings me to, and because you are a bit of an industry expert when it comes to digital and tech, are there any tools, technologies, apps even that you recommend for remote workers to help them manage their tasks, their communication, stay organized as well, Els?
Yep, there's so that was actually going to be my sort of next comment regarding, although we had technical issues at the beginning, but technology is always beneficial. And if it's used wisely, it can help, you know, structure your day and so on. I mean, a simple tool like a calendar that everybody has access to, you know, an email calendar could help you structure your day in a way where people can see your availability. They can see when you're online and when you're not online. That could, you know, massively help in that sense. There are tools like Monday.com, if you're aware of it, where it's more of a collaboration tool where you can assign tasks, set tasks, you know, set that your ongoing tasks, completing tasks and so on. So it's a very sort of collaborative tool which people can use. So there are many tools out there for collaboration, and they're all designed and they all became famous at the moment that the whole remote work thing started after COVID.
Some people saw some opportunities when the rest of us were distance learning. Making all the sourdough. Never, no more banana bread. Lastly, Al, so anyone who is thinking that the summer's a bit of a downtime when it comes to job hunting, what are you seeing in the market right now? Where are the opportunities? What strategies would you be advising any job seekers over these summer months?
Yeah, I think it's, a lot of people are traveling. There is a lot of, you know, hiring managers, people who do interviews and so on traveling. But, you know, from the trends we're seeing here in the office, it hasn't slowed down dramatically. There are still companies hiring. There are still employees looking for people desperately, especially in the technology space, which we are sort of covering here in the region. It never slows down. There are always projects. There are always deadlines. My advice is to always look for, the best way to find jobs is through your existing network. So ask your existing network, your ex-colleagues, your peers, et cetera, and they always know someone that is hiring somewhere. You know, this is how it works in the industry. Or, of course, you can go to recruiters who are active in the market and know what you know, who's active and who's not.
And some also some really good deals on courses I've seen as well. I don't know if I'm being targeted for training, but, you know, using this time to upskill, you know, upgrade your knowledge and just keep fresh, really. Alex, thank you so, so much for your time. Really, really appreciate it. And have a fantastic summer, wherever you might be working from. Alex Ismail is director at Mark Ellis Recruitment and Training Academy.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. to enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.